I'm Gene, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm very grateful to be here. Jim just said, wait a minute, you got to get laid. And I said, oh, okay. That's about how long it usually takes, too, so I appreciate that. So, was it good for you, too? I mean, you know, I'm a little kid. I'm very grateful to be here. You know, when I think about the gift that God gave me with my wife, Diane, I just get overwhelmed. I thank you, sweetie. It was great, great. This has really been a neat experience so far for me. You know, when I first got sober, there was a little group of people that hung out in Virginia Beach, Virginia, where I'm from. And they called themselves the Flowbirds. They were this mystical group of strange, assorted characters that kind of followed this guru-type woman who was a little bizarre around. And I had come right out of, with my Marine mentality, somebody took me to this house. And and I was awestruck. Now, considering where I came from, I should not have been a judgmental kind of person. But I immediately went in there and I was looking at all these people that didn't seem to be worried about nothing. And one of them is here tonight, and it was so moving to me, Tom C. from the Hilo side. And I was so touched because when I saw Tom at one of my very first meetings, he had long blonde hair and a beard, and I remember he was wearing a sheet. He said he had something, it was not a sheet, it was sheep, and no shoes on. And I was very regimented in my thinking and said, what the hell is this? This guy's got a sheet on, for crying out loud. And he can't be cool. And this woman would look at me and just go, poor child, just lighten up, lighten up. And I would say, lighten up? What's that mean? You know, and I would just relax. So I, after a brief meeting or two, I got away from those strange people. But I love you, Tom, and I'm glad to see you here. And I've had a chance to communicate with him online in this little group we belong to. It's really been neat. And I am just so happy to be here. I was thinking that when I got to AA, my life was like a runaway train going downhill. You know, and there was going to be a crash. And I knew there was, everyone around me knew there was going to be a crash at the station at the bottom of the hill. And even my sponsor would say, well, there's going to be a crash, there's no doubt about it. But if you don't drink, and you just hang on, you'll survive the crash. And I'd say, but you don't understand. He'd say, he never said there wasn't going to be a crash. In fact, he said, there's going to be a crash. But if you don't drink, and if you just hang on, you will survive the crash. For anybody who's new here in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, anybody who's relatively new, I want to offer you just a little bit of hope that if you hang around these people in this room and you don't drink, without being perfect, you will be able to stay sober 27 years. I can tell you that. Okay? Without being perfect. And I can tell you that I am so far from perfect. But I used to tell people, I got sober too young. I wasn't done screwing up just normal stuff yet, you know. And I was raised in a household, military household, like my wife. My dad was a career military guy, and my mom was an alcoholic. And the joint was jumping. We had six kids, and you know, if you anyone who's ever been raised in a household where alcohol runs the joint, you know it's a very exciting environment. And my environment was very exciting. I had strange uncles when my dad was gone. And my mother was a absolutely gorgeous, unbelievably talented, beautiful, beautiful person who was an alcoholic. And it's just that simple. And just as I was to do many years later, when you're an alcoholic, you do what makes you feel good at the time. And that's just the way it was. When you grow up in that kind of an environment, you tend to come up with ways to avoid things and hide out and all this other stuff. And I did. I escaped into sports, and my main sport was baseball. And I became a real maniacal kind of an athlete. And, you know, I was pursuing this primarily to avoid having to deal with any of the stuff that was going on home. And I would always, as I was growing up, I found ways to feel like I fit in. I always had a common feeling that I noticed alcoholics and addicts have is we have an emptiness. There's a hole. Something's missing. And that was always the case with me. There was something missing. And I would do things to try to make that hole get filled. And I was looking for the piece. There was a piece missing. And I was searching for that piece. And I would make these decisions that were crazy to try to fill that void. You know, I graduated high school when I was 17. I wasn't really a good student, but I managed to get by going to summer school and stuff like that. And to make myself feel like I fit in, I decided to join the Marines. Now, you know, give it a break. Maybe a little therapy or something, but to join the Marines because you feel like you don't fit in. And everything I would do would be good for about 90 days. You know, I was one of them 90-day guys. Everything, I could really go like hell-bent for 90 days, and then after that I'd have to get another, because the hole would come back. It seemed like it was like a 90-day hole. It would come back 90 days later, and I needed something else to fill it, and so I'd make another crazy decision. So when Diane talked earlier about changing, I'm still trying to fill up a hole, honey, sometimes when I'm changing. And it hasn't changed a lot, except she doesn't sweat it too much anymore, you know. But everything was about 90 days. And so after 90 days of being in the Marines, you know, I got out of boot camp and I got a great job for the Marine. Now, I hadn't done much drinking up to this point. When I was in high school, we got some wino to buy us some beer, and I'd drink it, and I didn't even like the taste of it. And then I'd act drunk and maybe go to a dance and get into a fight and anything to be cool. I was always trying to be cool and fit in. But the hole came back after I was now in the Marine Corps and I got promoted to private first class, and I got this great job driving for an admiral, and the hole was starting to come back again, you know. And I mean, you know, it should have been a great job. You'd have thought, for crying out loud. As soon as I got driving for this admiral, I got promoted to sergeant. You know, admirals don't like private first classes driving for them, you know. So, man, I was moving up the ladder quick. In about 14 months, I was a sergeant, and I was driving a big black Chrysler with the lights on, and it had flags on it and stuff like that, and it was a cool car, and I wore dress blues all the time, which was cool. I liked that, so, I mean, I looked cool, and I had my white brass stuff here, and sometimes I'd drive with the lights on even when I didn't have the admiral in the car, just so I could drive around, because people would always be saluting the car and all, you know, and I liked that. I was working on my self-esteem. Carry on. I'll be all right. Admiral, you need to say anything back there? He's asleep. Anyway, now I'm in the Marines. I'm driving for an admiral. And me and the admiral would go places socially. And he would go and start doing some drinking. And while I'd drop him off, I'd have this big fancy car. I'd go park it in a bar parking lot and go in and start drinking. And then I'd be driving him home at about, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night, and I'd be drunk, and he'd be drunk, and, you know, we're saluting everybody. There aren't many admirals' cars that get stopped for drunk driving. They don't pull you over too much. You know, you could actually probably fake it and say, I'm on a mission, I'm trying to weave here. Don't be pushing me around. But anyway. But the hole came back again, you know. Here I was now driving for an admiral. I'm a sergeant in the Marine Corps. The hole comes back. And I thought, I made another one of those really solid decisions. I say, you know, I think what the real problem is, I think I need a woman in my life. That's the missing piece. You know, in those days, young guys got married and girls got married early. And I said, I think that's what I need. I said, I think I need a woman. And I had dated a girl in high school. And I said, I think we need to get married, you know. And, you know, if you're real sick, and I was very sick, I didn't know I was as sick as I was, you tend to attract other real sick people. It's like a magnetism. It really, it is. And it's, you can even hear the suction when y'all run into each other. I mean, if you listen, it's like a, you know, and I mean, have you ever been in a mental hospital or anything? I mean, well, you never been in a mental hospital? Remember when y'all were in a mental hospital? Or at an AA convention? And you got a newcomer sicko guy and a newcomer sicko girl, right? There may be someone here right now. Listen for the suction. You can hear it. You can, and they're magnetically attracted to each other, especially in a detox. I mean, you can hear it like across the room. They're all over the place, you know, and they're standing outside talking about spiritual things and moving to another level. And so I had this young girl I dated in high school, and we were magnetically attracted to each other, and man, and it was going to be fantastic. I mean, even the sex is great when you're that sick. I mean, it's like something from outer space, and it's going to be forever. It is. But the truth is, it's good for about 90 days. And then the hole's back. And now I'm a Marine sergeant. I'm driving for an admiral, and I'm married. And the hole's back. And I'm not going home too much now. I was like Diane's first husband. I was not coming home. And the war in Vietnam got going real good, and I made another one of those really great decisions. You know, I was telling the Admiral one night on the way back from someplace, I said, you know, Admiral, I used to call him Admiral. I didn't want him to think I was sucking up to him, you know, and I'd say, you know, Admiral, and he'd look, he was an Arkansas fella, and he had these bifocals on, he'd look in the mirror, and at me, I'd say, I think I want to go over and get my teeth involved in that war. And he's looking at me like this, and he's saying, well now, Sergeant, you sure you want to get involved in that damn mess? And I said, yes, sir. I said, I am a trained killer, you know. And that's what he did. He laughed. And this melodramatic brain of mine, I was saying, I don't want to miss this one. And he said, well, now I can get you over there. And he did, too. And admirals don't want sergeants driving for them that don't want to be driving for them. I mean, it's considered like a posh job. I mean, I got over in Vietnam and immediately went into my real job, which was infantry. And I got to tell you, when I got to Vietnam, the North Vietnamese Army were not concerned about my hole at all. And they didn't have any concern about my childhood issues. My experience in Vietnam as a sergeant in the Marine Corps was not a time that I was particularly proud of. And the reason for that, I think, has got a lot to do with the fact that I did a lot of things there that went against my moral fiber and that went against my... I never really thought I was a pacifist until I got back from Vietnam. And then I started reevaluating my entire world of priorities. And it was just such a confusing time for me. And I'd done things I was ashamed of and I had lost a lot of good people over there, and it was just a very emotional time for me. And I came back from there totally different emotionally. Now, it was at that time when I got back that I started drinking a lot because I had a lot of voices. You know, there was a new vengeance that I was drinking with. I had a lot of new voices and new things I was trying to block out of my brain. The hole was huge at that time, you know, and I wasn't coming home, and my wife and I pretty soon, when I first got home from Vietnam, I was in the hospital for a little while, and then after I got out of the hospital, I was just drinking all the time, and my wife and I got divorced because I wasn't coming home, and then I moved into the barracks, and And as time went on, I was just riding around. I had a job as a sergeant of the guard. I rode around with a bottle of beer in my lap and a loaded .45 on my hip, driving a truck with a red light on it. And it was a dangerous job for me to have, really, because And I did that and just stayed drunk all the time. And it was at that time I was locked up in my first psychiatric hospital. I started having anxiety attacks. Now, I don't know if you've ever had any anxiety attacks. I'll kind of give you a rundown on what my first one was like. Okay? I was in a bar shooting pool with a guy, and all of a sudden I had this tremendous tear that swept over my whole body. My palms got sweaty, and my legs got wobbly, and my chest got tight, and I thought I was having a heart attack. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I told the guy I was shooting pool with, I said, "My God, I can't breathe. You got to help me." And he said, "Whoa." He said, "No hell, it's your shot, man." He thought I was kidding. I said, "No, I said, I can't breathe." And we got in his car and we roared off to the emergency room at Portsmouth Naval Hospital in Virginia. And I ran in and I said, "Doc, you got to help me. I can't breathe." There were two corpsmen, Navy corpsmen sitting there, and they looked at me and they said, this was in 1968, and they said, "You can't breathe. Well, how long have you not been able to breathe there, Sarge?" I said, "I don't know, man. 20 minutes. How the hell I know?" And they said, "Oh, Navy corpsmen love to jerk Marines around anyway, you know." And they said, "Can't breathe for like 20 minutes. We better take care of you." And so they checked me over, and when they checked me over, they said, "Well, we don't find anything wrong with you physically." And my biggest fear was I was going to come home from Vietnam and go into one of them wacko states where I would start shooting people. I had this fear I was going to kill everybody, you know. And I mean, I was a little loose in the head there. And so I said, "Well, thank you." I said, "In fact, I do feel better. I feel better now." And I said, "I appreciate that." And so I left. I wanted to get the hell out of there when they said nothing wrong physically. And I left. But I got to tell you now that for about the next 5 months of my life, I went back to that emergency room and parked outside almost every night, waiting to die, waiting for that panic attack to come back. I didn't know what was wrong until finally they put me in the mental hospital that they had there, and they said they would check me over. And then I was finally discharged. They said I had a passive aggressive personality, and they were right. In fact, out of the like five mental hospitals I was in, I was diagnosed like different at all of them, and they were all accurate. I mean, really, the last one was like anxiety neurosis, which means, you know. And I say, see? Damn right. I wanted them to find something wrong. And in the end, many years later, they discovered I had something called survivor's guilt, which is a... part of that PTSD stuff and all that. But anyway, I was rolling. I got a discharge, you know, and now I had to go get a job. I was no longer in the Marines. I went and I got me a job selling insurance. And I want you to know that I was the number one insurance man for the Prudential Insurance Company for the first 90 days. And I went to this woman I had divorced. Now, you have to understand something. I was Catholic. And Catholics in those days didn't even recognize divorce. So I really wasn't divorced. But she was Methodist. So she'd been divorced. So I said, "Look, why don't we try to make this thing work?" And she said, "Well, I'm not shacking up." I mean, she had good morals. And I said, "Well, okay." And she said, "But if you want to get married again, we can do that and do it right." I said, "Okay." So we got married again, and, you know, six months later, I was parked in my car behind the Norfolk General Hospital waiting to die, and they had a ward two where they put people who died a lot, like me, and in fact, I'll never forget, and this guy might have saved my life. In between hospitals, I would go to, like, just doctors. I was looking for the person with the answer to my problem. You know, I'm looking for the magic fix here. You know, I'd go to a psychiatrist and give him a shot. What the hell? You know, I'd give you like one visit or two maybe. But you better show me something, you know. I mean, I was looking for some. And I remember with this one guy, I'll never forget, I figured this was like the fifth psychiatrist I'd been to. I'm going to give this guy a rundown real quickly of what's wrong with me so he can tell me what I need to do. And I went in and I said, okay, here's the deal, doc. I started talking about the Catholic Church, my alcoholic mother, the Marine Corps, Vietnam, my divorce, and my behavior problems that were getting a little suspicious. And it was in the first sitting. He hadn't even talked yet. And so I got done and I said, so what do you think? He said, about what? I said, what do you think the problem is? And he said, well, what you just described to me is life. He said, the problem you got is you don't think you are supposed to go through any of this stuff. I never went back to that psychiatrist. But I never forgot. Because what he said to me was, he stole my victimhood from me. He snatched it right, I didn't even know I had it, but he snatched it right away. And he might have helped save my life. Anyway, my wife and I was going out drinking all the time again, and I wasn't coming home selling insurance drunk and just going crazy. And one day I went to a 7-Eleven store. I'm not proud of this. My daughter was now born, and I just didn't go home. You know, when I was so afraid of myself and my behavior that I didn't trust myself around people I loved or around anybody else, so I just didn't go home. I just disappeared. And I went down to Virginia Beach and I got a job as a waiter at a restaurant down there, and I did that for a while. And after about a year, we were now divorced again. And one day I was down walking on the boardwalk in Virginia Beach heading to my job. I used to wear a tuxedo to this job. It was a fancy restaurant. And I'm walking down the boardwalk and my wife, or my ex-wife, saw me, and she had been doing a little drinking, and she drove her Mustang up the boardwalk, tried to run over me, you know. And so they had these summer cops that walked around Virginia Beach, and I grabbed one of their attorneys to be, and I said, officer, I said, this crazy woman tried to run over with the car. And he went over and talked to her, and he said, she says she's your wife. And I said, no. I said, we're divorced. I said, in fact, that was one of the reasons, is she's not stable. And he said, he said, I don't know who to believe. He said, but you take her home or I'm going to put you both in jail. And I never forgot that. And so I took her home. And, you know, in case you know anybody that's ever been divorced, 5 times. What you can do is sometimes when you get in divorce, you have that magic reuniting moment, you know, and maybe you can make it happen again. And I got in the car to take her home, and you could hear the suction again, man. And we got back at our relationship, and she said, I said, why don't we try to make it work? Remember, I'm Catholic. I've never even been divorced yet. And she said, well, I'm not shacking up. And she said, plus I'm not marrying somebody again who's a waiter. So I said, okay. So I got me a job driving a beer truck. And I will tell you this. I was the number one beer truck driver for the first 90 days in that company's history. I did do very well, and they made me a district manager. My job was to drive around and buy beer for people. I was the beer man that would go into a bar, you know, and buy everybody draft beer, and it was a great job for a drunk. I mean, my God, it was my job to drink is what it really boiled down to. And so now I had a company car, and I had a coat and tie and an expense account, and I went ahead and went back to her, and I said, look, why don't we try to make it work again? And she said, well, I'm not shacking up. And I said, well, whatever. And so we got married again, and It's almost crazy when you think about it. I mean, she was sick. Well, here's the real deal, okay? You can be divorced if you're Catholic. I didn't know this then, though. I mean, I didn't know. But even now, I mean, I don't know unless they've changed the rules, but you can be divorced, but you just can't ever have sex again. That's right. Well, you can, but if you die, you go to hell. And, I mean, that's serious stuff. And I'm a sexual kind of guy. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I am. And I've had some great sex in my life. Right, darling? But I've never had any worth going to hell for, I'll be honest with you. So I said, okay, we'll get married again. So we got married again, and God, what a mess. It was, by this time I was just so screwed up. You know, I really believe if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever, if you don't treat the addiction that you got, you're going to acquire other problems. You know, I don't know, you know, I've sponsored enough guys and done enough fifth steps to know there are no pure alcoholics, you know. They don't exist. You know, I mean, what about all them animals and all, you know, I mean, what about this strange behavior you got here? I mean, so there's a lot of stuff that goes on. There's no pure alcoholics. And in my case, my behavior was getting over the edge with other areas. I was all locked into lust and pornography and voyeurism and the whole deal. In fact, I was getting so out of whack, I was just drinking and being a pervert. It was a full-time job. I mean, it was interfering with my regular job, which was getting more demanding. I was at a bar shooting pool in a pool tournament, one of my accounts, and I had called a meeting for all of the route salespeople at 4 o'clock, and 4 o'clock came, and I was drunk in this bar. I couldn't make it back. I was a mess, and I called in to say I can't make it, and the secretary said, well, wait a minute, what do you mean you can't make it? You've got 16 route salespeople waiting here for you to review budgets with. And I said, well, I can't make it. And she said, well, let me put the boss on the phone. So the owner of the distributorship got on the phone. He said, Gene, he said, what's the matter with you? I said, I can't make it. I've got too much stuff. I'm in the middle of something here. He said, you can't make it. You've got all these guys here. I said, look, I don't need this kind of pressure. This is the logic of an alcoholic, right? I'm saying, if you can't deal with this, this company car is not that big a deal to me. I've been with these guys for 3.5 years, and he came and got the car and took it. And I walked home in the rain with my pool trophy. And fell in the front door of my pregnant again wife, and I told her I just quit my job. And she had gotten to that point that when they get to this point, it's pretty much a done deal. She'd gotten to that whatever point. You know, when you're greeted with a whatever, just go ahead and get your stuff, because and before long I had gone from that whatever, and now I was running around practicing this voyeurism thing. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but that's a... In fact, I went to a public health psychiatrist for that one, because I was really scared about that. I mean, that was one of them things that was getting a little bit out of hand. And, you know, I used to have to go to public health psychiatrist because I'd been to all the other ones and I couldn't get in. And public health psychiatrists, they always give you like a Iranian psychiatrist or something, or Afghan or something. And they're all probably great psychiatrists, but I mean, you can't understand them, so you don't really know if they know what you're saying, you know. And I remember, but this one guy, his name was Fazi Abdu. I remember him very clearly, and He was a little short guy with bushy eyebrows and a mustache. He looked like a psychiatrist, you know. And I remember I went and I said, I didn't want to tell him what I was really doing. The reason I used voyeurism is because it sounded somewhat French. You know, it didn't sound as disgusting as what it really was. And so I remember the first time I met with him, I said, you know, Fatty, I used to call him Fatty, I seem to be having somewhat of a problem being a voyeur. And he's got these bushy eyebrows and he's going, voyeur. Dumb peeping Tom. And I said, well, I don't know what the hell they call him in Iran. He said, I don't do that. I don't do those. That no public health. So I was rejected by one more psychiatrist. And I left out of there. And, you know, I ended up just going completely over the edge. In fact, I checked into the last mental institution I was in, please God. I had a pint of moonshine in my back pocket. I felt like the world's most disgusting pervert in the world, and I was scared to death. And I checked in, and I was standing out front, and this big old gal came out and put her arm around me. She said, come on in here. We're going to love you till you can love yourself. And this big old brother came over next to me and said, come on, brothers. Come on in here. We're going to love you till you can love yourself. And they took me up to the nut house. There was a drunk section downstairs and the nuts were upstairs. They walked me past the drunks up to the nuts and they said, what's your problem? I said, I'm a damn pervert. And they said, oh yeah. So I don't know if you remember this from your mental institutions, but in the last one I was in, we had like 12 people, 10 women and 2 guys. Now, it was one of them, it was 1975, it was one of them co-educational mental hospitals, you know, where everything's liberal and free and, you know, everybody's walking around in bathrobes and nobody's got door locks or nothing. And you know, I'm in there with a group of 10 women and 2 guys and of course, I'm the new guy. They didn't call you a patient, they called you a member of the community. And they say, well, members of the community, we have a new member of the community, Gene. Gene, would you like to tell us why you're here? And I'm looking around at these damn women, and I'm saying, you know, I mean, I wanted to get well, so I just laid it out there. I said, well, I'm a damn pervert, and I can't quit doing it. And of course, the other women in the group are backing up. My doctor says, now, Mary Beth, that seems to bring out some feeling in you. You want to share on that feeling? You know? I believe I healed most of the women in the group. And I left with just one more notch of hopelessness on my belt. And there's a laundromat in Virginia Beach, Virginia, where all the bums and winos hang out on 17th Street, and I started hanging out with them by choice. I know while I was in that psychiatric hospital, my wife moved out pregnant with her daughter, and understandably so, never to return. And I just walked out of the hospital when they found out I didn't have no insurance and walked down to Virginia Beach. Started stealing wine. I'd steal Mad Dog because I had flat bottles. I could put 2 or 3 bottles around my pants. And I just sucked on Mad Dog wine or Wild Irish Rose or any of that other stuff I could steal. And I hung out in that laundromat and stayed there with the rest of them bums. And that was probably about a 5-month existence that I had there. And we were all volunteers. You know, the other man, and God has a strange way of working, because the other man in my group, you know, I told you they had 10 women and 1 guy, he watched my annex. I would go in and out. If you stayed sober, I mean, if you looked like you were making progress, they'd recommend what they call status, where it meant you could leave the psychiatric hospital at like 3 o'clock, like right after pottery. You could leave, and then you had to come back like before 10. It sounded like they were going to blend you back into the community. And so, you know, my chart at every mental institution I was in always would read the same. First night, patient extremely nervous, up all night, didn't eat anything, angry, sweating profusely. Second day, patient nervous, sweating profusely, didn't eat anything, scowling at other patients. Third day, patient ate a little bit, slept a little bit, walked past group therapy session, wouldn't participate. And fourth day, patient slept in late, ate everything in the patient's refrigerator, taken over group therapy session. And what has happened really to me is that the hole's back, and I got to get something working. You know, the old, the missing piece is there, and I got to get something. Well, you know, they perceive this as progress. So they took a vote and said, why don't we let Gene go on status? Well, it was really, I'd take time to tell you this little story because it's really ridiculous when you think about it. My roommate was a black fellow named Curtis. Now, Curtis was a bona fide manic depressive. I mean, Curtis had papers. He was a great guy. Curtis was about 6'4", weighed about 110 pounds, was skinny as a rail. Afros were in 1975, and Curtis had an afro like this. Curtis looked like a mushroom, really. So the group said, well, look, since Gene is doing so good, why don't we see if Curtis would like to go on status with him? Because Curtis hadn't been out lately, I can tell you that. And when Curtis was manic, he thought he was God's gift to women, all women. And when he was depressed, he was suicidal. There didn't seem to be a gray area with Curtis. Okay? So I'll never forget, the group was holding a little vote, and they said, Curtis, we're recommending Gene for status this Friday. Would you like to go with him? And Curtis was on his Thorazine stuff, which kind of made you just stare ahead a lot, you know. And even when he was looking at you, he was not looking at you. He was just kind of... And Curtis said, status, my man Gene, shit. Which meant, that'd be great. So we did. Me and Curtis were walking down this affluent neighborhood in Virginia Beach, Virginia, which is a southern town, and we looked like a Mutt and Jeff Oreo, you know, walking down there. And we walk into the bar called Dante's Inferno, and Curtis leans over the bar and to this beautiful blonde-haired girl behind the bar. It's Friday afternoon. Construction workers are all sitting around there. Curtis says, hey, mama, what's happening? And I said, give me like 9 drafts, and, you know... And the construction workers are, Curtis getting rejected by everybody. The construction workers are threatening us. I'm trying to console them by letting them know we're in the mental hospital. We have armbands here. You can get as froggy as you want, but I'm going to tell you, we are in the mental institution. And I ain't sure what he's in here for. Anyway, we got kicked out of there about 2:30 in the morning, and I went back and they said, relapse. And they were right. They were right. You know, that last guy who was in the nut house with me, he was an old man named Bob P. And he watched my annex in and out. And he made a comment to me one time in group. He said, how much do you drink? And I looked at him very angrily. I said, what's that got to do with anything? He said, well, I'm an alcoholic in AA, but I haven't been in about a year. And now I'm in here for depression. He said, but I've been watching you and listening to you, and we got a lot of flaky cats like you in AA. And I thought, I might be a lot of things, but I ain't no alcoholic. I left out of there and went down to that laundromat, but I couldn't shake that guy's image. I couldn't shake it. He planted that seed in my brain. So Christmas Day of 1975, I called Alcoholics Anonymous up. And when I did, I asked a buddy of mine if I could use his apartment to call him because I was pretty much on the street and I you know, I hadn't bathed and I was a mess. And he said I could. He said, but, you know, he knew me. I'd been in the beer business with him. He said, just don't sit on the furniture if you don't mind. He said, you know, just kind of sit over somewhere. So I called AA up, and I'll never forget this evening. The guy answers the phone. He says, Merry Christmas, Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, how disgusting that is. I said, look, I might be drinking a little too much wine. He said, well, you know, you're my Christmas present. And I thought to myself, well, this guy must be having one hell of a Christmas out there. He said, I got a bunch of guys sitting around here just waiting for a live one. I said, well, you know, whatever. He said, I'm going to send him out to you. So he sends this guy out to me, and I want you to visualize this guy, right? And I know, Jim, you know Big Tom, right? This guy comes walking in. Now, I had cracked the door at his apartment. It had an aluminum door. Now, by the time he got there, I'm about 45 minutes. I have had no wine. I'm losing my mind. I used to always hear train whistles and babies crying when I'm coming. And seeing, I mean, you know, I was in the real deal here. You know, I mean, I'm seeing bugs and stuff and babies crying and train whistles. And it was very confusing. And I'm sweating like a dog. And this guy hits the door, and it's like a... You know, you get sensitized when you're coming off of booze, you know, and I'm going, oh, God. But now I'd already had clicked into the pity mode because I figure, what the hell? I mean, I'm already surrendering. I might as well get all the pity I can get, right? So my meek little voice, I go, come in. And this guy comes walking through the door, and I visualize this guy. He's about 6'8". He weighs about 290 pounds. He's got a pair of bib overalls on, and he's carrying a banjo. And I look at this guy, I thought I was hallucinating. And he walks in the room and he looks around the room and he spots me over in the corner and he goes, well, damn, Bubba. Bet nobody's told you that they love you lately, have they? I'm thinking to myself, man, this is the story of my damn life. Here I am, a divorced, cowardly Catholic pervert. I finally call AA. They send me out a 6'8", 290-pound, banjo-toting homosexual. I thought, oh man, go ahead, take your best shot. I'm too weak to do anything. But Big Tom must have known what I was thinking because he said, no, Bubba. He said, I love you just like you are. He said, you're going to be a damn sight tougher to love once you get all cleaned up. And boy, the wisdom in those words. You know, he threw me in the back of his pickup truck. He had another drunk in the front of his pickup truck that was drunker than me. I thought he was like the guy that drove around picking up drunks, you know, like at the Nazi ghetto, you know, bring out your drunks, you know, and the... We went over to this old lady named Melba's house. I remember these names. I really do. I mean, Melba was an old lady about 70-some years old that liked alcoholics. She wasn't one. She just liked to have them around her, you know? I don't know what the hell is up with that. But anyway, we go to her house, and Tom says, come on, we're going up to Melba's until the meeting starts. So I'm hearing voices and babies crying and train whistles. And we go up to Melba's, and I'm sitting at the dining room table with my hands in my head in my hands. I'm shaking and just going out of my mind. Tom's got this damn banjo, and he's got this other guy holding a guitar. He can't play a lick, but he was shaking so bad that he was making noise with the damn thing, you know? And Tom is just chiming right in with him. And Melba's rocking in her damn rocking chair, looking at me dying, and she says, see, if you don't drink, you can have this too. And I'm thinking, I'm going to kill everybody. Anyway. We got to the AA meeting, and I'll never forget. You know, glory is so fleeting with drunks. I always try to find me a redhead in the room if I can, because, you know, God gives us what we need when we need it. You know, I come into the room. And I'm just losing my mind now, but as soon as I walk in the room, my first AA meeting, there's this gorgeous redhead in the room. And as soon as I spot her, you know, my whole routine changed. I mean, I'm 2.5 hours still hearing voices, and all of a sudden I'm putting on the cool. You know, I'm scraping the damn lima beans off my shirt here, and I go breezing on over to her a la Curtis, and I say, "Hey, what's happening?" She goes, "Oh, God." She said, "Keep coming back," and off she went. And in my sick brain, I'm thinking, she'll be back. As soon as she finds out I'm an ex-Marine, she'll come back. I came to meetings 90 days. You know, my first job, I got washing dishes at a steakhouse. So I could go to 3 meetings a day. And I did. You know, when you're young and Alcoholics Anonymous, you get sober. You get your health back quick. It doesn't take long to get a good job. After 90 days of washing dishes, it got me a good job. Got real important. Couldn't go to quite as many meetings. 120 days into that deal, I got drunk. Got locked up in a state institution. Got out of that 2-week stint. Got me another job. Got me a new girlfriend. Got me a car. Got cool again. Quit going to meetings. Got drunk. Lost a car. Lost a girlfriend. My first year, I was in and out doing that charade for about 4 times. I had such a hard time. I didn't want to be one of you. I look at you today, and I look at what you brought into my life, and I say, how could I have not wanted to be one of you? I didn't want to be one. I didn't want to be one of me, but I didn't want to be one of you. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was so out of my mind. I really was. I just didn't know. I mean, I was so confused, you know. Finally, I came back in October 29th, 1976, and my sponsor, he was a tough man, and he said, come on over here, tough guy. He said, I'd gotten to a point where I was at a 7-Eleven, and I was gonna steal wine, and the guy was watching me, and I had to have a drink so bad, and I was thinking about how am I going to walk out, and which bottle will I hit him with when I walk out, because he was looking right at me. I needed a drink, though. And I think that was when I had my first spiritual experience. A thought crossed my mind that, my God, if I don't have a drink, I'm going to lose my mind. I had a history of convulsions by that time, and the guy, the thought said, if you're going to die, at least die trying to do what's right. And I put the bottles back up in the rack, and I walked out, and I came to a half hour later with a rescue squad around me. I'd had convulsions out in front of the 7-Eleven and what have you. And there was a young sailor there that was staying up with me that previous night. And the rescue squad guy said, we better take him to the hospital. And this young sailor said, no more hospitals for this guy. He said, he's had enough hospitals. He said, if he gets sober, if he dies, he's going to die sober. But he ain't going to die drugged up and hospitaled up. And he took me to an Easy Does It Club we have in Norfolk, Virginia, and I shook, and I shook, and I shook, and I sucked on Cairo syrup. You ever get Cairo cocktails? They put some knee-high irons, and I sucked on that Cairo syrup, and I hung on, man. And I kept thinking, when am I ever going to get right again? I just hung on. And hung on. And hung on. I'd go to the meetings and I'd walk around the room because I couldn't sit down. I couldn't sit down. I just was too screwed up. And pretty soon I got a couple meetings under my belt. I'll never forget Walt Kelly. I went to my second or third meeting on my return trip, and I'm losing my mind, and I'm hearing voices, and Walt says, come here, hey, come here. I went over to him. He said, go over there and talk to that guy. He's brand new. I said, brand new? God damn it, I'm hearing voices. He said, he said, go tell that guy how long you've been sober. So I walked over. I said, so you're a newcomer, huh? He looked at me and said, how long you been sober? I said, I got 3 days. He said, that's all you get out of 3 days? He didn't really say that. But he looked at me like that. God. Anyway, but I didn't drink. I kept coming. I kept coming. I kept coming. God Almighty, I took a job washing dishes again. And I somehow ended up about 6 months sober working at the club, the Easy Does It Club, sweeping the joint up. They paid me for that. I had no car. I had nothing. 6 months sober, I had nothing. As Diane said, I was COD. Some guy who I sold cars with the years during one of my careers. He said, I want you to meet this girl. And when I first met her, I knew when I met her, I knew I was going to fall in love with her. But as she said so aptly, she didn't pay me enough attention. I needed a lot of attention. And she was damaged. But I knew that I was going to fall in love with her. The problem was, I wasn't in love with me. And I had to get in love with me before I could really love anybody else. I hated me. And I remember that same guy, Walt Kelly, I remember me saying to him one time, I don't know why I'm alive. I don't know what I got to offer. Everybody's life I've touched is screwed up. And he said to me something I'll never forget. He said, that's why you went through everything you went through, because that's what you got to offer. And I truly believe today, you know, when I got sober, I look back and I say, you know, there's a lot of guys in that laundromat. A lot of guys just as deserving of sobriety as me. A lot of them. There's only one reason that I'm sober and some of them died drunk. And I truly believe this. I believe God has some of us picked out to carry the message to the other alcoholic. And that's our mission. So that we can keep this thing moving. And I believe that God allows some of them to die drunk. And that's their message, the power of this disease. And I believe that their message is as important as our message. So I would urge all of you, if you had a relative or somebody you loved die drunk, don't think that was in vain. That was a powerful message. I also believe that if I'm not carrying the message to another alcoholic, then I'm not fulfilling what God's will is for me. So I better get busy doing it. You know, Diane has been a joy in my life, and I really believe that without the Al-Anon program, there's no way in the world we would have ever been able to stay married for 26 years. Good God. 26 years. I mean, I'm not good with relationships, generally speaking. I mean, same woman for 26 years. And we've had some interesting experiences now. We're going to share on when Kevin asked me what topic we wanted to use for the workshop tomorrow. Hell, I didn't know. I said, I asked her. She went. I said, how about practicing the program in relationships? And he said, are you sure? I said, sure. And then I hung up and I thought, oh my God. That's a lot of pressure. First of all, we'll have to stay married till we get to Hawaii. But we're going to take that for the best shot tomorrow and see what happens. Once again, I want to close. I want to thank the committee. What a great committee. You red shirts or whatever you are, man, what a great job you do. I want to thank Dick and CB. You have been absolutely the most fantastic hosts in the world. CB, you are out of your mind, and I love you, darling. And I want to thank Kevin and Kelly for finding the wisdom to bring Diane here. You did good. And Jim, I love you, buddy. Peace, all of you.
You've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.